Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Welcome to Tech Talk, RNIB Connect Radio's regular journey into the world of accessible technology from a blindness and low vision perspective. I'm your host, Dave Williams. And don't forget, of course, Tech Talk, it's your technology show. So we would really love to hear from you. You can get in touch, send an email, maybe even attach a voice clip. The address for that is techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's T-E-C-H. talk@rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week, I'll be speaking with RNIB's Lisa Adams about technology used by people who are partially sighted. And we will be having a chat with Claire Sisk, known on social media as Can't See, about the NaviLens codes that are now available on the Aunt Bessie's Yorkshire puddings. And Tasneem Arshad will be here with another tip for the iPhone and using the iPhone. So that's all coming up this time on Tech Talk. Welcome in to our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman and Tasneem Arshad. Hello both, how are you? What's grabbing your attention in the world of technology this week?
Hello, yes. So I'm revisiting some JAWS tips, actually. So yeah, I'm kind of enjoying going through the whole sort of system tray with Windows and B and just arrowing through those. It's quite a nifty shortcut, really enjoy that. And then I was struggling to get out of it without having to select something on there, and Windows D would get you back to the desktop. So yeah, I'm kind of just going through a refresher of those and finding it really helpful.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, two things there. One is always good to brush up on your screen reader skills, because obviously that's the main way in which many of us access our devices. Those keystrokes you mentioned, Windows key and B and Windows key and D, they're actually Windows keystrokes. So you can use those regardless of which screen reader you're using, or even no screen reader. I think sometimes we get a little bit muddled with that. Which keystrokes the screen reader and which keystrokes actually the Windows or the app? How are you, Callum? Are you a hotkey ninja?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, this is the interesting thing, isn't it? I love JAWS, but it's a real beast, isn't it, when it comes to keyboard shortcut. If you ever look at the JAWS keyboard shortcut list in the manual, it's endless. It's ridiculous.
Oh, I don't know. Have you tried VoiceOver on the Mac? Control, Option, Command, left elbow?
No, I'll tell you, the number of people who have been amazed when I've been using keyboard shortcuts, particularly on Windows, the number of people who are amazed at these shortcuts, they try them out. Someone was amazed by Alt F4 the other week when I mentioned about that to close apps, or if you're on your desktop, that will bring up the kind of shutdown dialogue. And apparently that goes back to the days of DOS, apparently, which I never realised, that shortcut.
Wow. I remember a trainer saying the way to remember that is Alt F4, shut the door.
Fantastic.
So there we go. So how do you remember your hotkeys? Let us know. All right, guys, stay tuned. It's another Tech Talk.
RNIB were recently present at the Dundee Accessible Gaming Symposium. David and Paulina were there, and they've been speaking to some of the participants and the organisers. Let's hear from them now.
We're at the Accessible Gaming Symposium at Abertay University, and I'm now joined by Dr. Robin Sloan, Senior Lecturer in Game Design. Robin, thanks so much for joining us here.
Thank you for having me. It's really great to be here.
So, this gaming symposium with Abertay University in partnership with RNIB, what was Abertay's impetus for doing an event like this?
Well, we've been teaching game design for more than 20 years, and I've been doing game design or game production for as long. And it's always been my interest about making games as accessible to as many users, players as you can. And I think that's something that we always strive to do in game education. But it always did kind of irk me that there were certain things that are challenging to approach in terms of fully inclusive design in games. Games being the way they are, the kind of medium that it is, it's perpetually innovative. It's always trying new things. It doesn't necessarily standardize into sort of set codes and conventions the same way that many other media do, which makes it actually a bit tricky. There's not really a how-to do things for games so much, which frustrates a lot of students because they like to know, well, how do I do this? And then the answer is usually, well, we're going to have to try and find out because it's not quite the same as the media. And with that, I think a frustration for me has always been that the inclusive design element is challenging because there is not necessarily a go-to even rules of thumb, you know, heuristics we'd call them, sort of rules of thumb, that things that work. There is in some cases, and we know that, but in a lot of cases, I find that games just don't really have an answer. And having worked with a lot of games companies over, I worked in games prior to this as well, but having worked with a lot of games companies, I kind of know the pressure that game developers are under in terms of just simply the pressure of making a game and therefore their capacity, their overhead to deal with additional accessibility issues is challenging. And I guess that's kind of where I came in when R&B reached out to talk about this. I kind of jumped onto it right away because I understood the challenge.
So there's lots of different breakout sessions going on at these symposiums both today and tomorrow. What are you looking to get out of them? You've got these thought leaders in the industry putting their heads together and working out what to do to make gaming more accessible. Is that what you're looking to get out of them?
Definitely, for me, that's one of the things that interests me. I think more than anything, I'm an academic. A large part of academic is just speaking to people and bringing people together. And I think the kind of people we've got in the room across the board with the symposium, but in particular within the breakout sessions, it's bringing people who work in game engines and technology, who beat the fundamental tools for games, game studios, people who are actually making games from quite large studios down to smaller indies. So that's a good breadth of insight. And through, most importantly of all, through to those with vision impairment who play games. And I think that's probably the biggest conundrum for a lot of game makers, because getting access to players generally is quite challenging. Getting access to players who have a particular experience of playing, even more challenging. So I think being able to bring these people together and actually just bounce around ideas throughout the 6 breakout sessions, I'm kind of hoping that it'll give us some clues as to what are the biggest challenges, but also what are the potential routes forward? What can we do next? And particularly as we are a university, I mean, like I said, we bring people together, but we also try to lead on R&D and support industry with R&D. So I'm hoping from a kind of academic point of view to identify what are the projects that we could propose and lead on and support R&IB and other stakeholders, our games industry partners, and bring in users as well to try and make some inroads and towards solutions.
Dr. Robin Sloan, thank you so much for joining us here on R&IB Connect Radio.
Thank you again.
We are at the Accessible Gaming Symposium in Dundee. It is very, very exciting, and we managed to grab Julie Kennedy, lead UI tech artist at Build a Rocket Boy Games. It's so nice having you here, Julie. How are you? How are you finding the symposium so far?
Oh, so far it's fantastic. It's hugely invaluable to us to actually hear from the words of from visually impaired users, the challenges that they face. Like, we can always try our best to meet their needs, but we can only guess, you know, without actually talking to them.
Because that is the thing I've been hearing a lot today from VI gamers. They are really looking forward to being able to share their experience of gaming. And do you think there's a change happening in the industry with more recognition that people with disabilities do want to take part in gaming and do want to try out the newest games?
Very much so. We've seen a lot of blockbuster games recently that have championed accessibility features, and it's hugely exciting for gamers and it's hugely exciting for developers as well, because it opens up a whole new avenue of design challenges for us that we can finally meet, and also tech challenges as well, standardizing the technology that allows accessible features to be implemented is hugely exciting for us.
So do you think we'll see more symposiums like this one happening all over the world?
Oh, hopefully. Like, I'd be so sad if we didn't. Again, it's just the best way to further the cause of accessibility is to hear from visually impaired and other like differently abled users. Hopefully we'll see more symposiums like this. Hopefully we'll see more symposiums for users with other needs as well.
Fantastic. Julie, thank you so much for speaking to R&IB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm Dave Williams. Now, we talk a lot on the programme about technology for people who are totally blind, screen reading, of course, braille technology. But actually, 93% of people with sight loss do have some remaining vision. And I am really keen to know more about technology used by people who are partially sighted. And to help us on this journey, we are joined by Lisa Adams. Hello, Lisa. A very warm welcome to Tech Talk. What's your role? You work at RNIB.
Hi. Yeah. So yeah, thanks for the nice introduction. So I'm Lisa. I work in RNIB. I work in the challenge events team. So we basically kind of manage anything that, you know, physical that makes you sweat, basically. So any marathons, skydiving, anything like that. So I work in that team, and I work as something called the Challenge Events Engagement Coordinator. So I kind of help assist with all the kind of, you know, speaking to all of our participants and helping them raise lots of money and just being the kind of basic support line for everyone we support, really, and everyone that comes and raises lots of lovely money for RNIB.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, thank you very much for all your efforts in that department. Can you just tell us a little bit about your background, Lisa, and perhaps talk a little bit about how much sight you have?
Yeah, sure. So I have something called nystagmus. So I'm partially sighted. I've had nystagmus since I've been born with it. It's very odd having to describe it because I feel like a lot of the time, you know, you just kind of, I just kind of say that I'm partially sighted and don't have to describe it that much. But yeah, for my vision itself, I can, the way I would describe it is I can see enough that I wouldn't qualify for a guide dog, but I can't see well enough to drive. That's probably the best way to kind of put me. I'm in a bit of kind of a grey area in the middle, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's always tricky. My line manager, actually, he always says it's one of the most difficult questions that he get asked, how much can you see? Because he's got really nothing to compare it with. I mean, presumably you wouldn't be able to see enough to read like sort of standard newsprint, right?
Oh, no. So the main thing with nystagmus is the vision fluctuates all the time. So it's never, you know, with most kind of conditions, it's never constant. So with things like stress, certain light, tiredness is a big one. If you're ill, that affects my vision as well. So if I wake up tired and I'm poorly, then my vision is a lot lower than the normal. So yeah, newspapers and kind of any kind of small text is just not comfortable to read. If, you know, if I had to sit there and force myself to read it, I could really probably injure my injure my vision to strain to see it. But yeah, mainly 14 plus for kind of size wise, I'd say.
Right. And then, well, how about information on screen? I mean, would you sort of sit a standard distance away from TV, or would you get a little bit closer?
No, so typically, ever since I was younger, we have in our function where the TV is, I would just sit in front of it. We have sofas and stuff nearby, and people would be like, oh, why didn't you sit on the sofa? But it's just more comfortable for me to sit closer to the TV, so I'd sit probably half a metre away, I'd say, just to kind of see everything on screen. Same thing with cinemas, I'm used to kind of sitting right at the front just to get the kind of most out of it and just to be able to see everything.
Okay, so just sort of tell us a little bit about kind of growing up and maybe the sort of the role of technology and you, I mean, you mentioned there obviously sitting closer to a TV. At what point did you sort of start making things bigger or using magnification or perhaps some other way to adjust the world to sort of fit you, really?
So yeah, I think I would say from in primary school, my mum was very good when I was younger, getting me kind of loads of support and everything. So I'd always have a kind of a teacher assistant with me throughout primary school and secondary school. So I kind of, as I said, I find it quite hard because my vision fluctuates. Something that I would need one day, I don't need for the next day. So I've done a lot of trial and testing about what suits my eyesight. Especially kind of contrasting colours for laptops and computers and stuff. That tends to be a main one for me that I've kind of kept throughout you know, from primary school to now. And I prefer kind of a lighter background with dark colours if it's the other way around, because I did try that for a little bit with like white on a black background, but it was just it was a bit too bright, I think, for my fair vision. Yeah. I mean an example, I had it on my phone for kind of Instagram and Twitter and things, but it just wasn't, I found it a lot more difficult to read the white writing on top of the black than the other way around. So I had that mode on for a little bit because I thought it looked quite cool, but it wasn't practical for me, so I turned that off quite swiftly.
Right, so on these devices now where you get like dark mode, for example, that doesn't work for you?
I've got some notes up on my screen now, and I have it zoomed in by 310% to be exact. So I do have it zoomed in. Just anything that, you know, softens the kind of focus on my vision is what I like to do. But I don't have it so big that it's kind of more effort to be able to read, if that makes sense. So if it's like two words, you know, per screen, that's going to take me hours to finish something. So I do try and find a nice kind of balance between the two.
Okay, so it's about having dark text on a light background, maybe making things slightly bigger, but not enormous, just a little bit bigger, yeah. And what, if any, specialist technology have you used, such as video magnifiers, to kind of help?
Yes, I mean, I was very lucky. I went to university and I got disability student allowance. I think that's the official name. So they sent me a lot of technology to try out. Some cool little devices which you can kind of zoom in to like to papers and stuff, and then you can take a screenshot on that device, and then you can zoom in further if you needed to, which I do find quite useful actually. The only thing with that is it's quite bulky, so I didn't used to take it around too much. But you know, now and again, if I do need to see something on the back of like a ticket or terms and conditions, I'll still use that. And I would say, other than kind of that, the assistive tech I use kind of now is probably stuff that has evolved from like kind of Apple and things that they've kind of, you know, put into the device itself. So obviously you can make everything bigger on there, which is great. But I find the most useful thing, and this is going to sound a bit odd, but when I'm wearing my AirPods and someone texts me, obviously it reads out. And that is probably one of my most used, it probably sounds like the most basic thing ever, but that is definitely my most used kind of assistive way to when people message me, I would say.
Do you think partially sighted people sort of struggle with the idea of using a little bit of speech? Because it can be really helpful, actually, having information spoken to you. But, you know, in my experience, many partially sighted people are quite self-conscious about that. And you mentioned AirPods there, so obviously that makes it a lot more discreet, and therefore you feel a bit more comfortable with that. Do you find that when you talk with other partially sighted people that generally there is this sort of reluctance that actually, no, I'm not a screen reader user, I don't need speech? But obviously now speech is becoming more and more mainstream, you know, we've got smart speakers and all of that, so it's just perfectly normal now for even people with full sight to have information spoken to them.
Yeah, definitely. I think I was saying to my lovely manager the other day that I think coming to RNIB, I started here over a year ago now, and coming to RNIB was the first time I'd kind of properly kind of acknowledged being partially sighted. Because as I said, because I'm in this grey area, I think it's really easy to fall into, you know, trying to do things that people with full vision can do. So it's been a bit kind of neglected, I suppose, on my part. So I'm only just now, you know, being a little bit more open to having more assistive tech and stuff with me. I don't even think it's really an embarrassment part. I think it's just that I haven't ever, like, thought about it. It's not often that I'll kind of perceive myself as needing it, but yes, as I said, I think working here, obviously you know with the job role we do and kind of who we support, it's made me think, you know what, I actually do need a lot more support than what I'm using at the moment. I do think maybe with partially sighted people it's more of a transition and kind of letting go of what you think you can cope with compared to what you could use that could really help enhance your kind of experiences with phones and computers and everything like that?
Yeah, I mean, the beautiful thing about obviously a smartphone is you can take a photograph of something and then you can use Pinch to Zoom to get a closer look at it afterwards. And, you know, lots of people take photographs with their phones now. So that sort of normalized that a little bit. I remember back in the day, partially sighted people not wanting to be seen using a magnifier, for example, in public, because they felt that it was something that maybe labeled them in a kind of a negative way, but then they would still pick things up and bring them close to their face. And you know, my kind of reaction to that was, do you seriously think people don't know you're partially sighted? Like, people can just tell, you know. I think when you're young you try and hide it, but actually people know, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know, at a train station you can tell that my vision isn't the best by how close I am to the to the train boards that I can't really see anyway. So I just use my phone for that as well.
And it's okay. Like, do you know what I mean? It doesn't make you a terrible person. Like, just because you can't see well as the next person, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%. I think kind of as I'm 24 now, about to turn 25 next month. And I think being kind of open, even with my kind of friends and stuff my best friends from school and stuff, I don't think I had one conversation in school about my vision. throughout the whole kind of 5 years, but now I think, I don't know whether it's an age thing or whether, you know, working at RNIB has helped with kind of confidence building in that respect, but now it's all I talk about is what I can see and what what works for me. And, you know, the friends I made at university were really great and we're really close, and we'd always joke, like, when they're coming down the street, they'd text me in advance and be like, because I know you won't be able to see me coming, and I'm like, okay, that's great. So I think it has developed, and I think you're right. I think sometimes you can get very kind of wound up in, you know, not accepting what is probably best for you because you don't want to seem, I don't know, potentially not what everyone else is doing, but
What's normal anyway, right? You know, so...
Yeah, exactly.
It's important to talk about it because then that hopefully makes other people feel like it's okay for them to talk about it. And having somebody like yourself talking about it, you know, hopefully means that, you know, other young, partially sighted women would also then think, oh, well, you know, she's talking about it. Do you use any specific technology throughout your education? I think you went to uni and studied there. You mentioned a video magnifier. So that was that the only piece of specialist sort of kit, really?
No, so I did have, like, Dolphin. Is it Dolphin? I did try that for a while.
Supernova?
Yes, I did try that.
So that's magnification and screen reading software, depending which one you get, for your Windows laptop. Yeah.
So I had that, but I actually had, because... talking of tech, I'd studied media production, so it was all very kind of techie and like everything we did, but they were really great. So yeah, I tried that for a while. I just found that I wasn't very kind of consistent with what I was using, because, you know, something when I would need a screen reader one day, the next day, if we scanning through a documentary that I've just filmed, I didn't need that. So I found it difficult to kind of find a balance. But yeah, I use those two. I think I use those two probably the most, to be honest. I also had like a normal kind of recorder for when we had lectures, so I could record it and then listen back to it later on for like when I'm doing notes and stuff, as well as an actual note taker that, you know, helped me out quite a lot as well.
Right, okay. When you say note taker, you mean a sort of human person, not a specialist device.
So she would come in kind of, you know, for a couple of hours each week and write some very detailed notes, which were incredibly handy. And I think a lot of, funnily enough, I thought that would kind of make me stick out a little bit going to uni, having like someone to kind of, you know, follow you around. But the amount of people that asked me, oh, do you have those notes still from your lecture, be like, yeah, sure, that's fine, you can have them.
We'll hear more from Lisa and Dave a bit later on.
Now, I don't know about you, but I love a good old Sunday roast. And Aunt Bessie's, of course, have got a whole range of products. You know, they're well known for those kind of products, your Yorkshire puddings and your roast potatoes and all that kind of stuff. And they have recently partnered up with NaviLens to make their product information a bit more accessible and easier to read for those who are blind and partially sighted. And someone who's had some involvement in this and joins me now is Claire Sisk. And Claire, thanks for joining us. We'll talk a bit about the NaviLens stuff in a minute, but just tell us about a bit about yourself first. I mean, you've got a bit of a social media presence, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah. So I'm Claire, and I'm registered blind. I have retinal dystrophy, and I use social media to try and break down barriers and misconceptions about living life with sight loss.
Okay. And what is that on Instagram and those sorts of platforms?
So TikTok and Instagram, YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. I think they're all of them.
All over the place.
Yeah.
So talk to us about this NaviLens and Aunt Bessie's partnership. What's been your involvement with this?
So the NaviLens QR code is now on the Aunt Bessie's Yorkshire puddings and roasties. And I went in store with my NaviLens app and was able to locate the products, buy them, come home and cook them independently, thanks to the amazing partnership of RNIB, Aunt Bessie's and NaviLens.
Obviously, the beauty of the NaviLens codes is that they can be scanned kind of from a distance. So when you go into the store, how close did you have to be before you could eventually pick up the codes using the app and then kind of navigate to it?
So when I was walking down the freezer aisle, I hold my phone up by my eyes. I always say my phone's my eyes, and I don't know if that's why I hold it there, but that's where I hold it. And I was literally, I was probably in the middle of the aisle, taking up the whole space, and I was just scanning, and it's quite a distance it does pick it up from. I can't remember exactly what it is, but I was nowhere near the product, and I scanned it and it started the beeping and was telling me to go forward. And then I tried to put my hand through the glass, forgetting there's freezer doors there. And then once I'd opened the door, it was telling me like to the left. And then I was able to actually pick up the product because it directed me straight to it.
And then what sort of info do you get from the codes, you know, once you scan it?
Absolutely everything that is on the packaging then displays in the app and is read out to you. So it not only gives you your cooking instructions, which is obviously important to be able to cook independently, but it gives you all the ingredients, allergy information, and it even lets you know about your recycling options.
Okay, so basically everything that you could need to know.
Everything, yeah. It'll even gives you your nutritional information.
Yeah, and do you think this is something that you'll continue using then? I mean, it sounds like you're pretty impressed with it.
Oh, absolutely. I just hope that, you know, this Aunt Bessie's is going to pave the way for other companies to do the same and put the NaviLens QR code on their products so that, you know, the blind community can shop independently. It's something that's so important. You want to live an independent life. And this is certainly going to help us do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only kind of problem, I guess, that I could see is that it's, especially if you're in the supermarket, kind of having to hold your phone out in front of you, does that worry you in it at all, or are you quite comfortable with that?
Not really. I think we're in a day and age now where everyone has their phone out. I mean, I'm a white cane user, and the amount of people that trip over my cane, and I'll be with my boyfriend and he'll say, yeah, they're looking at their phone. I think it's the norm now. I feel like a supermarket is a safe environment to be using that in anyway. There's lots of people around. So, no, I feel safe doing that.
And do you think this is something that is going to roll out to more products on the Aunt Bessie's range? Do you know anything about that?
I'm hoping so, because I'm quite partial to a parsnip. But I think, you know, the fact that they have it on their most popular products, everyone loves a Yorkshire pudding and a roast potato, is amazing. I think it's the start of something good.
Okay, so if people want to kind of try this out, how can they get access to this? I'm guessing the app is cross-platform, so iOS and Android.
It's currently on iOS and it's hopefully going to be on Android, I think, by the end of October. So you just download the NaviLens app. And as soon as that's downloaded and you open it, it will go into it will use your camera, and you can just literally walk up and down the freezer aisle. And as soon as it locates a QR code, it will let you know what that product is and you can go for it.
Okay, fantastic. And I guess this is something that they seem to be getting everywhere, these NaviLens codes. Obviously, Kellogg's are using them. Pantene, they've been quite popular for using them as well. So this seems to be something that's sort of catching on in the kind of mainstream industry, which is pretty impressive.
It is. And Aunt Bessie's is the first in the frozen food product to be using it. So fingers crossed, it is paving the way.
Let's hope so. Claire Sisk, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll head back to Dundee now to hear more from the recent Accessible Gaming Symposium.
I guess lots of excitement happening today at the Accessible Gaming Symposium in Dundee. And joining me now is James Kyle, who was just on one of the panels at the symposium. So I quickly grabbed you during the break. How are you feeling?
Oh, great, great. Yeah, I'm loving the event. It's great to be back in Dundee as well. You know, it's a city I'm quite fond of. I was a student up here at Abertay actually for a year doing the master's degree in game development, so it's lovely to be back.
Oh, that's amazing. So how do you think it's going so far? Because the panel just happened, there was lots of questions. It seemed quite quick. How did you feel it went?
Oh, I mean, it's always nerve-wracking when you're on a panel like that in front of, you know, people who, you know, many of them are there to learn more about accessibility from the panel. A lot of people in the audience are experts on accessibility. So, you know, it's two different types of stress on you. But no, I feel like it went really well. Ben's a great host, and, you know, he's been doing fantastic work in the field of accessibility for a number of years. And, you know, the other panelists did great as well, you know.
So do you feel there's a pressure? I think you said pressure from both sides. So one's obviously to represent the VA community well and the VA gamers and make sure the gaming community and developers know what the needs are, but also, you know, to make sure your needs and everything in regards to accessibility is actually listened or heard in this case, and you get those changes in the future to the gaming industry, because we do want accessibility everywhere, don't we?
Oh, yeah, we do. And it's important for people to talk about it when they get the opportunity. I always feel that pressure when, you know, I'm in a situation like this to do as good a job as I can to make sure that I'm saying, well, basically that I'm saying the right things to developers. But as well as that, there's also, you know, there's always the knowledge in the back of my mind that, you know, as much as I can speak for, you know, people with maybe similar sight conditions to me, the range of sight conditions is so broad. And there's such a spectrum to vision impairments and sight loss, you know, and it's impossible for me to speak for everyone, even people who have the same condition as I do. You know, their experiences may be very different. And then, of course, if you take into consideration the levels of experience that they may have with playing games and with technology, you know, it's a difficult subject to tackle, for sure, you know, but I do my best. We all do our best to try and, you know, work with developers and to make the voice of blind and partially sighted gamers heard, and really to make sure that the industry and games in the future are more accessible to blind and partially sighted players and players with, frankly, you know, all sorts of disabilities as well.
Yeah, and that's the thing, by having these symposiums, having these conversations, bringing in visually impaired gamers with different levels of sight loss, it means you're getting the dialogue open, and you're also making sure features are adaptable and as customizable as possible, because that's what you want to do. You want to adjust the game to your level of sight or lack of sight or whatever needs you really have, because you might not want to have, you know, just audio cues. You might be okay with higher contrasts and bigger subtitles and things like that might actually help you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that I think games developers are starting to recognize. You know, it's features like these, you know, it's not just people with vision impairments that benefit from them. You know, it's going off the vision impairment track a little bit, but You know, you look at the statistics for the number of people that use subtitles in games, the number of people, the percentage of people who would enable subtitles or use subtitles if they were left on by default is much higher than the number of people playing games who have hearing impairments. And the same would probably be true for, you know, accessibility features implemented to assist blind and partially sighted players as well. Mm. You know, accessibility features normally, you know, assist players outside of their intended audience, and that's, you know, a benefit to the game. That's a benefit to the developers. It just makes their games better overall.
Yeah, and it makes it open to a wider audience, which at the end of the day, that's what they want to do. They want as many people playing their games as possible.
Yeah, yeah, totally. You know, it's, I don't want to talk about, you know, get into the vulgar business of profit and money, you know, but they are businesses, you know, and, you know, we yeah, I wouldn't want to say that accessibility features will make your games, you know, sell millions, but, you know, it does increase your audience. It enables somebody like myself to confidently buy a game. If I know it's going to be accessible to me, then I can spend my money with confidence and enjoy the game. And, you know, perhaps, you know, I'll buy the sequels or I'll buy games by that, you know, by that developer in the future.
And you can also join the community of fans, because it means you don't feel excluded.
Of course, yeah, because it's so much more than just a business transaction. It's a massive cultural, you know, platform. It's a massive cultural format. And, you know, it's important for blind and partially sighted people to be part of that in the same way that, you know, like books and films and other, you know, forms of media have been, you know, made more and more accessible over the, you know, over the past decades. So things like, you know, talking books, audiobooks, what's the one for TV and film? Audio description. That's the word. That's the phrase I'm looking for. You know, and obviously, like, games, they're interactive. They're non-linear. There's such a variety to them. They're far more complex than these other forms of media. But it's important to not shy away from the challenge, you know, so that blind and partially sighted people can get involved with that and have the same sort of gaming lifestyle and be part of the culture in the same way that their sighted friends and family are.
Oh, that was beautifully said, and I really hope that means for the future of the gaming industry that we will see this wider inclusion in society and more VA gamers. But in the meantime, it has been lovely speaking with you on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
Jeanette, so we're at the symposium here in Dundee. Would you mind telling us, why are you here?
I was actually invited onto one of the panels, as I'm a blind gamer, and I think it's really nice to be asked and to be able to introduce people to blind gaming and what I play and how I access the games themselves as I'm blind.
Now I have to ask, what is your current favourite game? Because I imagine you have a few, but the one that you're kind of loving right now.
The game that I'm listening to, or I should say playing right now, is called Red Tide. It's new, it came out last week. It's really exciting because I helped to do some beta work on it prior to its release. So it's exciting.
Oh, that's amazing. So are you noticing a lot more interest from gaming companies when it comes to, I guess, getting feedback from visually impaired gamers?
Yeah, even though the games initially haven't been created for the blind community, I think the gaming industry is realising some of the games can actually be changed slightly to allow better accessibility for everyone.
Because that's the thing, it's just about reasonable adjustments. It's not really that difficult. You just do some slight tweaks and things can work for you, especially games as well.
Yeah, the tweaking obviously depends on the style of game. I think if it's more to do with the video style games, it might need a little bit more of adjusting and allowing more accessibility to the text that's maybe displayed on screen to be able to be accessible via screen reading software. Or for those people that have some vision, maybe a bigger font. I prefer the games that have audio, which does help me play them a lot better because I can't see the screen.
Okay, so it just makes it way more accessible to you.
Yes.
What do you think, I guess, a symposium like this means to the VI gaming community? Because it's, I guess, the first of its kind here in Dundee.
Yeah, I think it's the first time anywhere in UK, I think. It's good that people are going to listen to us to know what we want. I think in the past they've actually decided what we wanted in regards to accessible gaming without asking us first. So it's not always text-based games that we want something a bit more exciting. And I think speaking to them directly and telling them what we want and what games we're actually playing at the moment, even if they're not meant to be fully accessible for blind, I think it's nice to be able to let them know what is accessible to us without them knowing or realising that their games are accessible.
Yeah, because you want to be involved in the gaming community. You don't want to be the one person that can't kind of join in the chat about that really new, exciting game that's just released.
That's it, yeah. And also, I think with the visual impaired community themselves like to chat about these things as well. We can go into the Discord channel, for example, and speak about the games there and share information with each other. And also the visual impaired community has got such a wide range of sight loss, and also depending on what access they're using, from screen reading software through to maybe magnification, etc. I think to let people know what's out there. And within the own visual impaired community, it's essential that we speak about this openly and to get more people interested in playing as well. That's part of the fun.
Oh, I love it. Well, Janet, I hope everything goes perfectly and that you enjoy the symposium.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I think it's gone really well and shown not only that the industry wants RNIB to do things, but that, you know, the industry wants itself to do things to improve, you know, the landscape as it currently stands. And it's great to see the enthusiasm, passion and energy already being, you know, put towards it, even in these very early discussions on day one.
It was great to just be in a room with like-minded people that are so passionate about accessibility in the industry. A lot of really positive and constructive discussions and a really nice kind of set of action points, some stuff that we can take away to our companies, but also stuff that RNAB and we can address as a wider thing, as a collaboration.
There are many ways to independently take notes. You could use Braille if you're a Braille user, you could type something using the on-screen keyboard, you could use dictation, or another option is using the iOS Voice Memos app. You can also share the voice memo as an email. Tasnee Marshad is up now to show us how that works.
Hello and welcome to your Tech Talk mini demonstration of how to send voice memos by email. Let's take a look as to what we can find when we open the Voice Memos app using VoiceOver. Open Voice Memos.
Voice Memo back button.
Okay, so I've asked Siri to open Voice Memos and I have a few here stored already. My list of voice memos are as follows.
Wood pigeon new recording.
So I've got a nature recording.
Quark new recording to
something else, which is a prayer.
Rams and quark. Wood pigeon home garden.
And another nature recording as well, amongst a few others. But if you don't have any recordings existing already, I would imagine you can go straight through to the record button, which we will hopefully have a find right now.
Record.
Okay, so there's button. The record button. So I'm going to double tap that and just record something very briefly so that you can hear that. So when you hear that noise, that means it's recording. I spy with my little eye voice note.
Pause button.
I then double tapped and you can hear that it now says pause. Let's see what else is available.
Done.
Okay.
Dim. Button.
Okay, so that done button is dimmed.
Pause. Fast forward.
Okay, I can fast forward.
15-second play.
I can play button. It, so let's go back and listen to what it says. So when you hear that noise, that means it's recording. I spy with my little eye voice note. So you have to scroll to the top.
City. Playbacks.
But again, if you've just got the one recording in there, that should be your only option to go to.
Fourth new search.
So it's named it new recording.
New recording to text field.
Okay, so it's called it new recording to. If I want to edit that and call it something else, I think I can just
search new edit title.
Okay, so I got to the edit title bit by doing one finger flick up, and then it just says edit title, comes up automatically. You double tap that.
414 CABEX.
And I can just dictate in here.
X-ray. Numbers. Dictate.
Tech Talk recording.
Inserted Tech Talk recording.
Okay, so that was good.
Edit. All recordings. Heading.
There's the all recordings option, which I had double clicked, and it's now presented me with a list of my existing recording together with the new one.
Tech Talk recording. 4:49 p.m.
Okay, so it's told me this is my new recording that I've just saved, and it's given me the time as well. If I wanted to email this across to anybody, what I do is make sure that the recording that I want is selected, and Tech Talk recording is selected at the moment. I do a one finger flick up.
More actions.
You've got more actions.
Move to folder.
Move to folder. So I'm flicking again.
Delete.
Delete.
Favorite.
You can favorite it.
Activate default.
Activate default.
More actions.
And back to more actions. That's what we want. So we'll double tap.
Talk recording. Close. Copy. Favorite.
So we've got.
Share.
We can.
Copy. Close.
We can
copy.
Either copy
button.
It,
share.
We can share it,
edit recording.
We can edit the recording,
duplicate, button.
Duplicate,
favorite,
favorite.
Move to folder,
you can move it
button.
To a folder,
save to files,
save it to files,
envision it.
Okay, button. So we don't want to do envision, so we'll just head back to share, because that's the option we require. We'll move back,
copy, close, share,
double tap
button.
The share. Go into
share.
There.
Lily.
It will bring up a list of contacts that you use frequently. So I'm going to skip through those and just go to mail.
Serac messages. Airdrop messages.
So we can airdrop it. If you're on an iOS device, we can message it.
Mail.
And there's
button.
Mail.
WhatsApp.
You can WhatsApp it too.
Mail.
But we'll go back to mail and
mail.
We will double
text
tap that.
Field is editing. Character mode. Insertion point at start. Send. Tech Talk recording.
So there's my file.
Heading. Cancel. Send. To. Text field. Is editing.
So in there,
character.
I can send it to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Or you can send it to a family or friends.
Add contact.
Or you can
button.
Choose from your contacts. There's a button there.
Castname.cc.
You can CC people in. And
Subject.
So it just brings up a normal blank email that you can complete as you wish. So I hope you found that useful. And we look forward to hearing your voice notes.
Thanks to Tasneem for that demo, and Tasneem joins me now. Do you use this regularly then? What sort of situations do you find this useful in?
Well, mainly as a backup, I guess. I don't use it often. I mean, if I'm out in the garden or, you know, kind of I've got a few nature recordings, or if I particularly want someone to recite something, you know, a particular thing that I'm quite interested in, I might ask them to do a quick recording. Or if I want to make a quick few seconds notes, or sometimes when I'm out on the move and I want to capture something, I might use it. It's just a quick and easy way of doing that. I have also used it in the past for, you know, if my PC's gone down in the middle of something and I need to write something down very urgently, I haven't had any sighted assistance around, I've just made an anonymous note at work. And then when the PC's back up and running, I can just transfer that across. So I do find them really useful. It's very helpful, I think. What are your thoughts, Callum?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I must admit, I don't really use it for notes as such, but just because it's so simple, isn't it? You know, you just open the app and then because it's a recording, you can just, you know, say whatever you want. You don't have to fiddle about with the keyboard or getting your Bluetooth keyboard connected or trying to dictate and hope that it makes sense when you read it afterwards. I'll tell you when I do use it, actually. I use it, and I don't recommend you do this because you're not supposed to record phone calls, but you know sometimes when you ring a number and it goes to an answer machine and it goes, sorry, please call us on 01, 02, 03, 04, 05, you know, just they just read out the number really quickly. You can never take that down. I can never keep up and type it. So I've got a little complication on the Apple Watch for this. So I can just quickly start a voice memo and just record their answer phone message. I can quickly grab the number. So I find that works really well.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I hadn't thought about doing that, actually. But yeah, what a brilliant recommendation. And I think it's really good for that sort of thing.
Well, let us know your thoughts. Do you use voice memos? Will you be using it more now you've heard that? Let us know. That email address is techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Hey, you could even try it out. Try recording us a little voice message and send it in.
We return now to Dave's conversation with Lisa Adams from RNIB. They've been talking about technology which is designed for people with low vision.
We're in conversation with Lisa Adams, a partially sighted colleague from RNIB's Challenge Events team. Lisa, is there any particular technology that you find is helpful in the workplace?
I mean, I use, for a start, multiple screens, about three, because, as I said, I have the text zoomed in so far that it's just easier to have that split across a couple of screens, and then you can do a couple of things at the same time. I do turn on dictator in Word sometimes, so that I find that in the afternoon when my vision's really tired, typing on a keyboard can lead to quite a few like mistakes and typos and stuff. So I find that being able to actually speak what I want to email is great. And it also cuts your email time in half. So if you haven't tried it, I'd definitely recommend it. We know whether you're partially sighted or fully sighted. I think that's a really useful tool to have. Other than those at the moment.
No, that's great. I mean, that's really helpful. And a couple of great tips there for anyone who might be struggling with reading information on screen but doesn't feel that they need a full-on screen reader, but actually doing a bit of dictation and having multiple screens and sort of zooming in. I mean, that may well be enough for some folks. I understand you use social media.
Yes.
So which platforms and why?
It's probably easier to go through the platforms I don't use.
Oh, really? You're across all of it.
Yes, I do like social media. I use Facebook. Well, Facebook less so. That's more obviously for kind of personal things, isn't it? Like, you know, your auntie's, I don't know, garden party that she wants to share. Twitter, TikTok is obviously a big one at the moment that I'm enjoying. I can spend hours on there accidentally. YouTube, I still use quite a lot. There's a lot of creators on there that I really enjoy kind of watching, listening to. Twitter, Instagram, I think that's most of them at the moment.
Okay, and is there any particular sort of VI content that you follow or would recommend?
Yes, I do follow. There's actually TikTok is a great place for that community at the moment. I'm not sure whether that is, you know, just a kind of general awareness of blind and partially sighted creators now, or just like who I follow. Let me find it. So I follow someone called Toby on TikTok. He is 20. He's blind. He wasn't always blind. I think he became blind when he in his late teenage years. So he's a really interesting perspective to kind of listen to, because he'll go through, you know, that thing we were just talking about how you can, he was kind of rejecting the fact that his vision was deteriorating and all this stuff, and how he kind of, you know, started using assistive technology and aids and, you know, the like talking scales and just basic things. But he does it really well, and he's a really great guy to follow. So I definitely recommend him. His at is Blind Tomes, if anyone's interested. And then I also follow Claire Sisk. She's also another TikTok creator, and she goes through, she's kind of more relevant, I suppose, because she does a lot of kind of beauty stuff, which is one of my interests. But she does it from the kind of blind perspective, which I don't think I follow too many people that do that. So she is also a great person to be around and to follow as well.
A couple of people there, and then of course there are people like Lucy Edwards, who is particularly well known, and Sassy Wyatt. I suppose she's on social media quite a lot as well. So what advice, Lisa, let's sort of draw this to a close. Thank you so much for being with us. What would be your sort of final advice for anybody in your position who might be struggling to use technology, who is partially sighted?
I would say just one, kind of ask for any support, and two, just do it for yourself because, you know, if you're kind of, as I said, if you're kind of nervous about, you know, using anything, or you're not sure what you want to use, which is also kind of similarly the position I was in recently, the only way you're going to know is to try it and test it, and also reach out to other people. There's so many online communities that I follow of you know, young women and people that from the kind of disability community in general, that I get so much advice from on kind of Facebook groups and things like that, so I definitely look out for those as well. And then you can kind of really connect and feel a bit more maybe kind of confident in your own headspace. And then hopefully you'll be able to ask for some support and finding the tech that, you know, is going to help you. Because I suppose at the end of the day, that's all you want. If you can, you know, use an app, but you struggle, you know, that's fine. And if you're not ready to move on from that, that's fine. But that is, you know, now there's so many solutions to enhance your kind of, you know, how you interact with social media and how you use it, that I think it's a great kind of era that we're in at the moment, that accessibility is hopefully kind of going a bit more mainstream.
Lisa Adams from RNIB's Challenge Events team, thank you very much.
Thank you, it's lovely to be here.
That's it for another Tech Talk. We always appreciate your company and, of course, the company of our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman and Tasneem Marshad. Bye for now.
Absolutely. Bye for now. See you next week.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.